coming, it's kind of awkward for me because I gave an earlier version of this talk less than a month ago in this room, but so that was the practice. And so those of you who happen to be in the last talk, of course you're welcome to leave, but it's you have a head start, so you can actually ask all the difficult questions that you forgot to ask last time compared to the first timers. So I'm going to tell you about physics beyond the horizon, and of course there could be things beyond our imagination, beyond the horizon, if we could look behind it. So Justin told me of my first affiliation, which is the Perimeter Institute. Now, if you look at the web page of PI, and so there's the whole logo, and this is PI and the name and everything, there is a small corner on the side that looks like a stars in the galaxy. And that's my second affiliation. Now, you thought that that's just a picture, but it's not. So this is my second affiliation since my degree is in astrophysics. I'm the only member of the Perimeter Institute Observatory, though, for now. We accept applications, though. And if you think this is a joke, there's construction underway as you for the observatory, you might have noticed. So submit applications, and they will be considered. Okay. Absolutely. Well, actually, this is not complete yet, but we can do our best without the equipment, if the sky is clear, of course. Okay, great. Now, onto the more serious stuff. What I'm going to tell you is a brief history of how a study of horizon, the farthest that we could see or we can see, has evolved from cartography in the old ages by explorers, by very adventurous explorers, to much later times where we do cosmology or cosmography by adventurous cosmologists this time around. So this is an old map of the world around 20 centuries old, which was painted actually by Ptolemy. Well, he actually described all the points on this map, but later on people, based on his description, made the map, but he had actually all the coordinates of these interesting points. And even back then, they knew that the Earth was spherical. So they did have an idea of the geometry. However, a lot of the places were missing in the map, so all these corners of the map were yet to be filled. And now we have a better understanding of how this thing looks like. Of course, part of it is night, so you cannot see it. But, sorry? Europe is not?
It's gone.
It's gone. Yes. Well, okay, so we know a bit more. There is no Europe in here? Are you sure?
The shadow.
No, this is Europe. Oh, somewhere. Sorry. Yeah, so, okay. So we know about Europe as well. Now, the status of cosmography on 20, so the size of this map is around 10 to the 9 centimeters, or 10,000 kilometers. Status of cosmology is kind of similar to what cosmography was 20 centuries ago. So this is a map of the universe. This time, every point here, instead of a geographical location, is a galaxy. And there are almost a million, few hundred thousand galaxies in this map, which is from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. The size of the map is 20 orders of magnitude larger than the last one. And similar to the last one, you see that there are lots of holes in this map, many places that are yet to be explored. This is actually about a tenth of the sky, so there is at least 10 times more area in the sky. And of course, you can go much farther than the distances that you see. There is universe, there is a structure in the universe beyond what you can see here. And that's really the homework for cosmographers yet to be done. So this is about a gigaparsec in size. Think that might be my BlackBerry. Okay. So, they're far away, then you wouldn't hear. So, this is the deepest snapshot of the universe. So in the center, you see what I showed you before, how far we could, which is how far we could explore the universe, at least in optical. But then there is a much deeper map of the universe, a deeper snapshot of the universe that you can make in microwaves. It's only a sphere. You don't have a three-dimensional image. But it's the deepest. It's an order of magnitude deeper, and it's really the as far as it goes. This is the horizon of our universe. By the way, if I didn't say this, please don't hesitate to interrupt me at any point if you think something isn't clear. So this is our horizon, and the study of the horizon has evolved from cartography to cosmography today. So that's yes, that's well the same thing. Of course, it's cartography and cosmography. Yeah, so I actually don't have any. I guess it's really the Earth that is spinning, so that's why this thing is spinning around you. Okay. So let me walk you through the history, a brief history of horizon. Basically, the farthest that we could see in measure distances. Of course, there are different ways of putting it, but I guess in my point of view, the first measurement of the horizon distance was done by Eratosthenes more than 20 centuries ago. And it's amazing that few people know this, that Eratosthenes measured the circumference of Earth to 1% accuracy 22 centuries ago. And he did that by measuring the angles of shadows in Alexandria and Sion, both in ancient Egypt, at midday. So this was basically the first measurement of the horizon, at least as we knew it on Earth. And that motivated Columbus and then Magellan and other explorers to try to go around the Earth and go to India and, the wrong way, and in the process they discovered America and so on and so forth. Now, the next measurement of the horizon or distance in the universe was by Richard and Cassini, where they measured the parallax of Mars. Basically, they measured how far Mars is by measuring the angular position of Mars from two different places on Earth. And that set the size of the solar system, the actual physical size of the solar system, which is the astronomical unit. And that's six orders of magnitude larger than the size of Earth. And it's much, much later, actually. The next step was about 200 years after that, where the distance to the first star was measured. And that was, again, by parallax, this time because of the Earth motion around the sun. Where if you look at the nearest star, you see that in the background of distant stars, its position changes as you look at it different times during the year. And that was how Bessel, for the first time, measured the distance to the star, famously to 61 Cygni, which is about 10 light years, or 10 to the 19 centimeters. The next jump in our distance scale happened in around 1920s, where we discovered that most of the stars, actually all the stars that we can see, at least with naked eye, happen to be in some island universe, which was the name that Shapley, Harlow Shapley, used for our universe. And he believed basically the whole universe is in this island. There's nothing else outside of it. So he was right about the island and the size of the island, which he found out from the motion of globular clusters in the halo of the galaxy. What he wasn't right about is that everything else that we see is in this galaxy. There are actually these nebulae, nebulae in the sky, which happen to be, some of them happen to be other galaxies like our own. And that was confirmed about 10 years later by the famous Edwin Hubble, who measured the distance to other galaxies, including Andromeda. And the distance happens to be around three orders of magnitude larger than the size of the galaxy. So around 10 to the 6 parsecs to 10 to the 7 parsec, or 10 to the 6 light years. So our horizon by now has jumped from 10 to the 9 centimeters to 10 to the 25 centimeters. And the final step was about 30 years later, so that the distance to galaxies increased gradually over time, but ultimately we reached this real horizon, or as real as it, the most real horizon that we know of at this point, which is the cosmic microwave background, which is where photons last scatter from the intergalactic plasma in the universe. And that's around, around 10 orders of, sorry, 3 orders of magnitude, 3 to 4 orders of magnitude, larger than the distance to the closest galaxy, which Hubble measured for the first time. And beyond that, we cannot really see anything. So our horizon increased by 20 orders of magnitude over the past 20 centuries. Is that it? Well, we can say something about what's beyond the horizon. For example, we know that the cosmic microwave background is very isotropic. So the fluctuations you see here are fluctuations of 1 in 10 to the 5. So the universe, even outside the horizon, must be relatively homogeneous. Otherwise, we would see some anisotropies as a result. And it turns out that the scale of homogeneity is probably around 10 to the 32 centimeters, which is 3 orders of magnitude larger than what we see. Otherwise, you would expect some large anisotropy in the CMB. And what's beyond that? So we'll be sitting somewhere down here, and the universe around us is more or less homogeneous. What's beyond that is really anybody's guess. And people plot pictures, but it's really like the unexplored territories in the old cartography maps. That's where dragons might be. Okay, so that's the history. Now, one interesting piece of physics that came from a study of horizons, and this is relatively late in the game, but that's what started a big part of modern cosmology, is the so-called horizon problem. So I'm going to walk you through the horizon problem. The standard theory of cosmology, you have the Big Bang. Early on, at some point, the universe starts. At some point, as I was telling you, the universe becomes transparent to photons, i.e., early on, photons cannot travel freely in the universe, but at some point, the density is low enough so that they can, and they propagate truly, so that's around 300,000 years after Big Bang. And sometime 14 giga-years later, these happen to be observing these photons. Now, if you calculate the causal horizon since Big Bang, basically how much light can travel since Big Bang until the last scattering, where basically we're mapping by looking at this microwave background, you see this is going to be a distance around a few degrees in the sky. So at last scattering, the causal horizon is much smaller than the horizon today, basically the whole sky that we can see. However, it seems that as I was telling you, microwave background is homogeneous to one part in 10 to the 5. So how come, although the photons didn't have time to propagate from one point to another point a few degrees apart, the whole sky seems isotropic to us, to one part in 10 to the 5? Now, there is really no good justification for this, and this is known as the horizon problem. Why the causal horizon is so much smaller than the scale of homogeneity that we see in the universe. And this is what started an interesting debate in cosmology, which led to the discovery of inflation, famously by Alan Guth, in about 25 years ago now. So it turns out that the period of exponential expansion can inflate the causal horizon exponentially. So if you have 60 foldings of inflation, that is if the universe expands within a short time exponentially by a factor of e to the 60, then it solves the horizon problem. So this is the picture of how this would look like. So you have an early period of inflation around 10 to the 30, less than 10 to the 30 seconds in the age of the universe. And during that time, the causal horizon can expand by many orders of magnitude. And that could basically make universe as homogeneous as we see it to be. And this is, of course, this is Alan Guth who came up with the idea. And this is his office. You can imagine why he would love some inflation maybe in his office space. So it turns out that this interesting idea led to very interesting predictions and, as it turned out, successful predictions. So the motivations by the study of the horizon problem led to the inflationary theory, which have some concrete predictions, although people argue about it. But certain predictions of, one of the predictions of inflationary theory, for example, is that the spatial curvature of the universe should be very small. And as it turns out, the latest observations happen to confirm that the curvature of the universe is, as far as we know, is consistent with zero. It's less than 1% in units of the Hubble constant, which I don't get into, or units of the critical density of the universe. Inflation predicts nearly Gaussian initial conditions. So different, you have linear modes that are independent of each other. That's Gaussian, and they have Gaussian statistics. And nearly scale invariant and adiabatic fluctuations. And this is the result of quantum perturbation theory. Actually, these two come from quantum mechanics. And all of these have been over and over confirmed with observations. So this is an example of the CMB temperature, which is as close as we see towards the initial conditions of the universe, as close to the initial conditions of the universe as we can observe. And you see that if you look at the histogram of temperature, log of the number of pixels of a given temperature as a function of the temperature, then it's exactly a parabola. It's consistent very well with a parabola, which is really what you expect from a Gaussian. And so this is normalized. So this is the units of the variance of this distribution. But it's a very good confirmation of this Gaussianity prediction. And now the other thing, the scale invariance, for example, you can try to reconstruct the initial conditions based on lots of observational data from microwave background, galaxy clusters, and et cetera. And this is from microwave background alone, the fluctuations of the microwave background. And you see that the amplitude of modes as a function of the wave number is basically consistent with a constant value. So it's a scale invariant fluctuations. So the inflation has been a successful theory. There are other predictions of inflation. For example, certain inflationary theories predict gravitational waves. And there's a lot of investment in the field, in experimental cosmology, to look for gravitational waves, in particular by looking at the polarization of the microwave background. But this is something that's yet to be detected. And it turns out that not all inflationary theories predict a large amount of gravitational waves. So that's something that we look forward to. But even if we don't detect gravitational waves, that just doesn't rule out the theory of inflation. Sure.
Yeah. Level, right? Which of these predictions, if you observe that they're not realized in our universe, would actually be very troublesome
for inflation?
Did you say gravitational waves? We don't observe them, there's not inflation. So what on this list?
None. Okay, so I think a curvature would be, I would think, and I think people might argue with me, but I think if you see a large curvature, that would be, I would think that would be the hardest thing to.
But they remember open inflation.
Yeah, no, so I think those are very contrived theories. So the thing about curvature is that if you have a large. Okay, so it's hard for me to imagine how a universe could have a large curvature but be isotropic. And I think you can come up with theories that do that. But it seems to me that if you suppress gradients, then this is also one of the things you suppress. So.
There are consistent rumors that we're seeing non-Gaussian.
Absolutely. So I'm gonna get to that.
And also, there are alternative theories
Absolutely. So there are other theories that could predict this. The thing is that no other theory, as far as I know, is as predictable as inflation is. So other alternative is just so hard. It's very hard to do calculations. So they may work, but the electronic model, of course, is much better than inflation. but that's. But yes, yeah, so it's easier to be seen. So the thing is that it's much easier to do calculation inflation than any other alternatives. And so that's why other alternatives need to be understood better. Yes?
Comment follow up on Justin, your answer to Justin's question. You said if you suppress gradients, you tend to suppress curvature.
Yes.
That's true, but it doesn't really seem to have anything to do with inflation. So it suggests that almost any theory that's capable of accounting for that.
Absolutely. No,
you can't. Likely to predict a very low curvature.
I never said that there's no other theory that can do this.
I'm saying almost any, by your own argument, almost any other theory that does account for the isotropy will predict a low curvature.
I think so, yes. I don't know of any theory that doesn't predict lower curvature but does everything else. Yeah. Okay. So that's where we are right now, and of course there are alternatives out there. They're not quite as well studied as inflation, and there's going to be a workshop in a couple of weeks on those very theories, if you're interested. So let me, before getting started with the main part of the talk, let me tell you about different horizons, and the blue doesn't come out though here, so I guess that's mental note for me. Inflation, so there are different things in different definitions of horizon, and this could be confusing for the people who hear about this. So there is an inflationary horizon, basically how far light can travel since Big Bang, or since the beginning of inflation. I can use either definition. And that's well defined. This is similar to what this is similar to particle horizon in general relativity. However, there are other definitions of horizon that people hear in cosmology. There's a Hubble horizon, which is basically C over H, the speed of light divided by a Hubble expansion rate. This has a dimension of length, and it actually comes in linear perturbation theory. So it turns out the perturbations on a scale larger than this Hubble horizon behave differently from perturbations smaller than this. And that's what people usually call super horizon perturbations and sub horizon perturbations. And then there is today's Hubble horizon, which is basically the Hubble horizon today. And this is the scale of dark energy. That's something else I'm going to tell you in a bit about. Now, actually, when people mention horizon in cosmology these days, if you look at abstracts of paper, usually this is what they mean by horizon, the Hubble horizon, which is not to be confused with the inflationary horizon, which could be much bigger, as I just told you, than the Hubble horizon. Okay. So, with that introduction, this is the outline of what I'm going to tell you. So I'm going to tell you a bit about cosmic acceleration, the ISW effect, and how we can use this ISW effect to learn about horizon scale physics. Then, based on that knowledge, I'm going to tell you about gravity on horizon scale, how you can learn about gravity on horizon scale using ISW effect, and then how you can learn about the statistics on horizon scale using the ISW effect. So this is another artist's impression of the cosmology. That's 90 degrees rotated, though, compared to what I showed you before. So here, Big Bang is here in this picture. And we are sitting here in the satellite observing the universe. So it was Big Bang, quantum fluctuations during inflation. And you had early times. At some point, the universe becomes transparent. You have photons traversing the universe freely after that time. At some point, fluctuations are large enough to form stars, galaxies, planets, and observers. And the whole thing lasts some 14 billion years. Now, there is an interesting piece of this puzzle that doesn't quite fit everything else here. this last 5 billion years, where the universe seems to be accelerating, the cosmic expansion seems to be accelerating rather than decelerating. But actually, this is not so surprising, because now we believe that very early times, there might have been a period of exponential expansion where the expansion was accelerating. But we don't know much about the early times, so I mean, people can have different ideas about that. Ekpyrotic doesn't need acceleration, for example. However, at late times, this acceleration, we see everything in the universe. And yet we see this weird behavior where gravity, instead of attracting, is repulsive and causes acceleration of the expansion of the universe. So today, we seem to be seeing everything in the universe, at least you would think, but yet we see this weird behavior. Now, people usually associate this with a dark energy component, a component with negative pressure, which causes this. And of course, this is invisible, that's why it's called dark. And this is not very surprising, because dark cosmologists used to have dark matter, so just add another dark component to explain this new phenomenon. But there are lots of theoretical concerns about what is the origin of dark energy. I'm not going to get into that. I'm going to tell you about the phenomenological implication of dark energy, which is the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. So there are two pieces of information in this slide. First is that the acceleration expansion results in decay of Newtonian potential. So it turns out that if you live in a universe where there is no dark energy and it's flat, so there is no spatial curvature as predicted by inflation, then Newtonian potential remains constant. So that's kind of interesting. But it turns out that the growth of a structure on the one hand, because gravitation causes clustering, and the cosmic expansion on the other hand, these two cancel each other in a way that Newtonian potential remains constant on larger scales. However, if you have accelerating expansion, that is, if you have dark energy, then Newtonian potential starts decaying, and you can imagine why that happens, because the structure stops growing, but the universe is expanding exponentially, so Newtonian potential is decaying in time. This leads in the ISW effect, which is the secondary anisotropy in the cosmic microwave background temperature. Now, what happens in this picture is that if you have Newtonian potential as a function of a space, and you have this decaying in time, you see that the photons that plunge into this potential gain more energy than the amount of energy that they lose when they climb out of the potential. So photons that are coming out here are more energetic than the photons that plunge in. So you can actually show that the temperature of photons out here is larger by integral of phi dot dt. So this phi is negative here. This is and phi is negative, phi dot is positive, so you get more energy out here. And of course, potential wells are associated with the structure in the universe. So basically, if you look at microwave background behind the supercluster in the universe, during the accelerated expansion phase, you see the ISW effect. OK? So why is it interesting? I guess you're going to see that in the rest of the talk. But basically, you're probing the potential. The point is that you're probing Newtonian potential on larger scale. So almost everything else that we have in cosmology probes density, which has its structure on a smaller scale. But potential has most of its structure on very larger scales, as it turns out, if you think about Poisson equation. So looking at potential through the ISW effect probes the largest structure in the universe, larger than almost anything else that you look at in cosmology, because everything else probes density. And this probes the potential. Okay. And this is the same picture. And this is where you expect to see the ISW effect. So this is the power spectrum, the angular power spectrum of the cosmic microwave background as a function of L, and L is something like 1/n. So a small L is very large angles. large L is very small angles. And since the ISW effect probes potential, which has most of its structure on very large angles, this is actually, this small bump on a in a small L is what you expect from the ISW effect. And at high L's, you actually, it's primary anisotropy, it's fluctuation in the last scattering surface. So this effect, secondary anisotropy on the line of, along the line of sight, just causes this small bump in very small L's. And if you look at the errors from the latest data with, from WMAP satellites, you see that the errors are huge, and this is basically the cosmic variance error, that is, they come because you have a finite sky. So you can never get any errors better than this, or almost you can never get errors better than this. So it's almost impossible to see the ISW effect by looking at the fluctuations in the CMB alone, because you are swamped by the primary anisotropy is mostly generated at the last scattering surface. There is, however, a way around this problem. If you cross-correlate the structures that you see in the galaxies with those in the microwave background, now the primary anisotropies in the last scattering surface, I just told you that they are generated an order of magnitude farther than where the galaxies are. So they are not really correlated with galaxy distribution. However, the ISW effect, as I described to you, is generated along the way on the places where structures sit. So if you correlate the distribution of the spatial angular distribution of microwave background with galaxies, the only thing that gives you a signal is the ISW effect. Now, this is an example that I have done. So this is the cross power spectrum of WMAP microwave maps and the galaxy map from two mass infrared sky survey. So that's 2 micron old sky survey. And you see that at the small L's, there is a hint of a positive signal with large errors again. But still, it's consistent that this is like a 2 sigma evidence for the ISW effect, that there is a small positive correlation between these two guys on the small L's. There are other things happening at large L's, but that's it's actually the Sinyavsky-Lubitsch effect that I'm not going to talk about here. So this is the interesting part, though. This is a hint, a way of extracting the ISW effect from the sea of primary anisotropies that don't tell you anything about dark energy. So it's really an independent evidence for dark energy. Now, people have been able to come up with other ways of explaining supernovae data. You may think they are contrived, but really to get this, you need, at least in a flat universe, you need dark energy. In fact, this was the number one breakthrough of the year, the fact that different lines of evidence for dark energy are consistent with each other, well, so-called cosmic convergence, and that includes the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect detections in different surveys. It was the number one breakthrough of the year about few years ago. So this is a really important piece of evidence for dark energy. Yes?
There are, there's an alternative model in which thinning of the supernova light is due to inhomogeneous structure.
Yes.
People can actually use these models to fit the same data. In that model, there is no dark energy.
Yeah.
There is no acceleration.
That's inconsistent with ISW. So I mean, there are different versions of these models, but at least the ones that are seem more realistic, they cannot explain the ISW effect. So the people who are interested in those models would like to somehow explain away this ISW effect.
So even though the light's coming through the structure,
yeah. The question is how local. So they need a local void, and if this is a small void, then basically you don't get any effect on larger distances. The question is how big this void is. So if it's a small void, it's okay, but then it doesn't, it's okay, I mean, it's reasonable, but it cannot explain ISW. If it's a very large void, then it's very contrived because we must be sitting at the center of the void. And so that's, at least that's my problem with this. That's, if it's a small void, then there are a number of observations that you cannot explain. If it's a large void, then it seems very fine-tuned because you have to be sitting at the center of the spherical void.
Sorry to keep you from that. That's okay. There is a model which is not spherically symmetric.
It's not.
It's an exact solution.
But then you have to explain why this, the mark of the background is so isotropic. Right? Okay. So, can you do cosmology with the ISW effect? Now, this is a very popular term these days. You hear the term precision cosmology, and everybody has his or her own idea about what precision cosmology means. These days, one of the popular definitions of precision cosmology is measuring so-called dark energy parameters, which is called W prime. So W is pressure of dark energy divided by density. W prime is its time derivative, et cetera. And there is a whole program, Joint Dark Energy Mission, that is built around that. And there are further extensions of that. Now, for cosmological constant, W would be minus 1, W prime would be 0. But of course, that doesn't need to be the true theory for dark energy. Turns out that ISW is not a good way to measure these parameters because it has large errors, as you noticed. However, it's a good probe of new physics close to the horizon scales, as I was explaining to you a minute ago. So if you look at the distribution of signal to noise squared for the ISW effect as a function of k, the wave number, so this is the distribution that you get. And for ordinary lambda cosmological constant, it's peaked around k of 0.01, and you also get contributions for a smaller case. Now, it turns out that currently galaxy surveys are essentially blind to a structure larger than k of 0.01 because they have a finite area of a sky, finite volume, and there are all kinds of systematic effects that you don't quite understand, say atmospheric effects, on very large scales. So at least at this point, ISW can tell you things that galaxy surveys or scale, can probe scales that galaxy surveys are not quite probing yet. There could be funny things or interesting physics happening far out here that the ISW is sensitive to. Now, so this is for ordinary lambda. If there is something happening on very large scales, something funny, then you might get a big ISW signal out here. Galaxy surveys still wouldn't see it because they probe the density, and it's much harder to see larger scale density perturbations than it is to see larger scale potential perturbations or potential fluctuations. So that's why ISW is a good probe of larger scale physics or horizon scale physics. And this is a compilation of different detections of ISW or pieces of evidence for ISW by cross-correlating WMAP with different surveys, galaxy surveys. So this is a function of redshift. So a small redshift, small distances. This is two mass, but I showed you APM galaxies, SDSS. I've been involved with this analysis, but the LRG analysis. And then there are deeper surveys at larger redshifts. And you see all of these are actually 2 to 3 sigma detections, but they are all positive, which is encouraging. And surprisingly, they are all higher than the prediction by the standard model of cosmology. So that's the thing that's kind of puzzling. So basically, so this is all the compilation of all data as of 2007. And they are around 2 to 3 times larger than predictions. Yes?
To make those predictions, they must have to know what the bias is. So
you can get the bias from the autocorrelation of galaxies. Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you know the cosmology, and I mean, you after WMAP free, you know them pretty well. Then you can get the bias from autocorrelation of galaxies, and then use that to get the prediction. So.
Go ahead. question. So the signal depends on sigma a.
That's correct. Yes.
How large is sigma a?
Well, so this is proportional to sigma n squared, because everything is proportional to sigma n squared. Now, increasing it by a factor of 2 means that you increase sigma n by 50%. And I think at this point, we know sigma n is to at least 10% accuracy, or even better, depending on statistical errors are actually better than 10%. But then there are different systematic errors, different ways are inconsistent. But yeah, so changing sigma it doesn't really help very much. Yeah.
So what is that based on constant lambda?
Yes. So you can try to play with different dark energy models, but the thing is that dark energy models are also you cannot play with all kinds of it, but they're already contrived. I mean, for example, W we know is very close to minus 1. So I think if you can come up with a very weird dark energy model, you might be able to do something with this. But I think it's the standard ones. They're already contrived that they don't change this prediction significantly. Okay. You can have some early dark energy model that could change things out here, maybe. So maybe somebody has to do this, but do this exercise. But the interesting thing is that all of these seem to be high.
Can that be translated into some statement about how the expansion might have been in recent times?
Yeah. So the thing is, the distance to the last scattering surface, we know that very accurately to be 1% weight, basically, and that's consistent with what you expect from lambda. From a cosmological constant. Now, if you want to change things significantly here by tens of percent, then you're going to change that distance as well. So, at least from a naturalist point of view, or I guess fine-tuning point of view, I'm not sure what's the right word for that. But that seems very contrived that you don't change the distance to the last scattering surface, but would change the expansion history significantly here. So. I can imagine you can come up with models that do that, but I don't think they're very natural. They're very complex. Okay?
So good. So what's the answer?
I'm going to get to that. I'm going to leave you with a question for the next 10 minutes and digress to something else. But I might have a tangible answer to that as well. So what can we do with the ISW effect? So this is one example, gravity on Poisson scale. Now, we have, these are two famous equations. One of them is, of course, much more famous than the other, the Newtonian gravity. that's why I put the titles there. So there's Newtonian gravity, inverse square law that we knew about for a few centuries now. And there is a universal constant of gravity, or Newton's constant, that enters it. And there's a Friedmann equation that is more recent, but I guess most of you have heard about, and describes how a homogeneous universe, so it's one of the first results for exact solutions in Einstein's relativity, and it describes how a homogeneous universe expands as a function of time. So this differential equation, A, is basically something like the size of the universe. Rho is the mean density, and P is the mean pressure of the universe. Now, in Einstein's theory of gravity, these constants are the same. And the question is, if they have another theory of gravity, we know Einstein's theory of gravity must be modified on some level, at least because it's classical, it's not quantum. In your general theory of gravity, would these constants be the same? So another way to put this is that there is the coupling constant in the general theory of relativity, Planck mass. And could it run on the cosmological horizon scale? And it's actually not very strange to have this. There are several models that could predict something like this. If you just have a minimally coupled scalar field with exponential potential, it gives it a behavior like this. If you have a Lorentz violating vector field, the so-called Einstein ether theories, they generally give, including as well as other things, they give you a running of Planck mass on the horizon scale. And another theory of incompressible dark energy that we came up with recently, the so-called Kaskutan, it also generically predicts a running of Planck mass on the horizon scale. And the generic predictions for all these models without any fine-tuning is that you have different constants of gravity on superhorizon and subhorizon scales, but these are nevertheless constants. Now, you could add fine-tuning to the model and generate lots of other interesting phenomenology, but without any fine-tuning, this is the general thing that you get, without introducing any extra scale in the problem. And this is an example of how Planck mass would depend on k on the wavelength or wave number. I think the red one is for Kaskutan model, and the green one is for the scalar field model. So we see that there is basically a smooth step in the effective Planck mass as a function of k. So these are superhorizon scale, these are subhorizon scale. Yes?
I mean, just why would it change by 5% and not by 5 orders?
It's a free. That would require a fine tuning, but that could be. Sure.
No, you're saying it would require. I mean, if you're just introducing the idea that Planck mass runs, since it's a dimensional parameter, shouldn't it run a lot? So that it runs like power.
So.
And then it would change by orders of magnitude.
So if there is. If your theory doesn't have any other fundamental constant in it other than Planck mass, then this running would be of order one. Now, if you add any hierarchy in the theory, it's like a much smaller mass scale. Like if the mass of this scalar field, or actually, so the scale in the exponential is much smaller than the Planck scale, then this could be much smaller than unity. But if you don't have any extra scale in the problem, only one Planck mass, then this would be of order one. Yes?
We know that you could provide PPM.
Well, that's really, I think that's more like 20% than like the 95%. But I guess, yeah, depends on. I think the most recent constraint from
all. From
well, I know there was a revision at some point, but there's, I think, a recent paper by Olive and somebody else. And that's around 20%. But OK, so I'm going to tell you. So I'm going to tell you the constraint. So there is actually a much stronger constraint than this running, which comes partly from the ISW effect. Now, this is the idea. If the G Friedmann is larger than G Newton, take it as an example, turns out that the phi doesn't remain constant during the matter era. So I was describing to you that if there is no dark energy and there is no curvature, phi would remain constant. But if there is a mismatch between these two constants, then phi actually would decay during the matter era, depending on the sign of the mismatch, decay or growth. Now, this causes two effects. Since phi isn't constant anymore, then you get the nearly ISW effect. So basically, since phi is changing all the time, integral of phi dot is never zero. So you get an ISW effect everywhere, which adds to the primary anisotropies of the CMB. So you get a boost in the CMB power spectrum. This is the plot I was showing you, this portion of the plot. So this is the late ISW effect. But actually, this early ISW effect would affect everywhere in the CMB power spectrum. At the same time, a structure formation is suppressed. And you can see this by measuring galaxy distribution in the sky or by looking at Lyman alpha forest. And there are other probes of that, or cluster distribution, for example. And there are good measurements of the matter power spectrum, a galaxy power spectrum. If you know the bias, that's a question that Mike asked. If you know the bias from some other means, you can measure the matter power spectrum. So this is a three-dimensional power spectrum of fluctuation in the universe. This is suppressed while this is boosted. If you combine all the data, you can actually put very strong constraints in this running, which is about 1%. So this is how you can use, this is an example of how you can use ISW effect to constrain gravity on very large scales. Because it tells you about how phi basically behaves on larger scales. And this is an example of if phi runs on the horizon, if gravity runs on the horizon scale, Planck mass runs on the horizon scale, how you would see it by looking at the how it affect CMB through the ISW effect. Okay, so that's interesting. Now, jumping to another application of the ISW effect, and this is where things are getting gets a bit more exciting, is the deviation from Gaussianity. Now, as John was saying, there has been some recent evidence or a claim of evidence for primordial non-Gaussianity. The way people usually quantize this, or quantify this, sorry, the way people usually quantify this is by thinking that the initial conditions in metric perturbations is some Gaussian field plus F and L, so this is just a free parameter, times the same Gaussian field squared. And there are different ways of parameterizing it, but this is the convenient parameterization, and most constraints are quoted in terms of this F and L parameters. It turns out that minimal, that is single field, single scalar field inflation, gives you F and L less than 1. And you should remember that phi g is the order of perturbations in the metric, which is 10 to the minus 5 or smaller. So if F and L is less than 1, that means that the non-Gaussian term is 10 to the minus 5 times the Gaussian term. So that's really tiny. It's almost impossible to see. However, there are other models that give you much larger F and Ls, like multi-field inflation, ekbarotic scenario, that Justin recently had a paper on that. If you have non-canonical kinetic terms in your action, so it's single, even if you have single field inflation but not with non-canonical kinetic terms, they all can all give you F and L much larger than 1 generically. So detecting F and L would tell you something fundamental about the initial condition of the universe. This, if you believe inflation is the initial condition. Now it turns out that WMAP tree gave very good constraints on FNL, something like 30 plus and minus 42, about a couple of years ago. And this is the maximum L, the maximum multiple that they kept in their analysis, L max of 500. Now, more recently, and this is what John was mentioning, there was a claim by Yardaf and Vandelt from the University of Illinois, where they improved the estimator that WMAP group used, and they used more data, basically went to higher resolution, and they got an actual claim detection of FNL, which is 87 plus or minus 30. So this is very exciting. And the question is, does this rule out single field inflation? So single field inflation has been the dominant theory for the past 25 years or so. But is this an evidence for failure of single field inflation? Now, I'm not going to answer this question. I'm going to tell you something else. So one implication of the non-Gaussianity on the horizon scale is that it couples modes on very large scales and very small scales. Of course, Gaussian fields, different modes, different Fourier modes are decoupled. But if you have non-Gaussianity, that's not the case. For example, if you look at the small scale fluctuations in this phi field, it's the same small scale fluctuation in the Gaussian field, but modulated due to this non-Gaussian term by the large scale modes. So a small scale statistics of modes is actually modulated by large scale modes. And this modulation is controlled by this FNL parameter. So statistics on the small scales like galaxies could probe modes on the horizon scales if there is a non-Gaussianity. So on larger scales, galaxy distribution, for example, would follow the potential, this phi g, this is like the Newtonian potential, rather than dark matter density or total matter density. So this is a recent discovery, which is kind of obvious in the hindsight, but it can have very dramatic consequences in terms of observations. So galaxy distribution would be much more inhomogeneous on larger scales, because as I told you, potential on larger scale is much more inhomogeneous than density is. And if FNL is a large value, like 100, this effect would dominate any Gaussian effect that you could think of. Now, this is a slide that demonstrates that. I'm sorry, it's taking a bit too long. So if you have only Gaussian bias, so larger scale modes only modulate the background of a smaller scale modes. So if you have a larger scale density fluctuations, where you have a larger background density, you have more galaxies because there's more peaks past the threshold. On a small, where you have a smaller background density, you have fewer peaks that pass the collapse threshold. So this is how galaxy distribution is modulated on larger scales. However, if you have non-Gaussian bias, the actual amplitude of fluctuation is modulated on larger scales, not just the background. So different, the larger scale modes can modulate the amplitude of a small scale fluctuation. So here you get larger peaks, and here you get the smaller peaks. And this is how larger scale, if you look at larger scale distribution of galaxies, this is how they're modulated. And since this is controlled by the potential, this could be more important than the Gaussian bias, which is controlled by the density, the background. And it turns out that the ISW effect also follows the Newtonian potential. So if you look at the cross correlation of galaxies and CMB, the ISW, the same plot that I showed you in the early on. So this is the Gaussian prediction, but if you have a large non-Gaussianity FNL of about 100, you would get much larger signal on a small L, that is on small angles. Since you have this extra modulation, you get a much larger cross-correlation between galaxies. Galaxies are much more inhomogeneous, as I was telling you. And this is the data. As I was telling you, data is much higher than the theoretical prediction. So this is consistent with FNL of 240 plus minus 120, which is around 2 sigma evidence, consistent with what Vandalf and company found. So just looking briefly in the future, and I have to finish, and sorry it's taking too long. A Planck satellite in 3 to 5 years is going to give you an accuracy of around 5, delta FNL of 5. So if FNL is around 100, you're going to detect it with 20 sigma with Planck satellite. The method I just described to you, if you have a good survey of larger scale structure, this is signal to noise as a function of FNL. So you can measure FNL with accuracy of 3, which is comparable with what we get from CMB alone. And this is rather insensitive to systematics because you are correlating two different surveys. The systematics of individual surveys wouldn't screw you, although here they possibly would. And there's similar accuracy for upcoming larger scale structure surveys, but if there is no systematics, and we have to understand the systematics better. So this is a conclusion of what I've told you. So I told you about the ISW effect, probes new physics on larger scales, close to the horizon. It constrains, severely constrains running of the Planck mass on the horizon scale, less than 1%. And in correlation with galaxy surveys, it probes primordial non-Gaussianity, and there is tentative evidence for this at the 2 sigma level. So answer to Lee's question, primordial non-Gaussianity might be the reason behind the discrepancy in ISW detections. Now, what are we going to see? So there are theoretical challenges that we have to address. Gravity in the infrared, cosmological constant problem. So this is something we have to understand. And there are certain reasons to believe that gravity might be different just at the horizon scale because of dark energy. Now, origins of and observations of primordial non-Gaussianity, that's a different approach to the super horizon physics by looking at the statistics on very large scales. And what are the possible pieces of evidence or signatures of primordial non-Gaussianity? And other possible signatures of super horizon physics, how would we find out about things beyond the horizon? So these are really theoretical challenges that we have to address. On the observational side, there are certainly many efforts that could help us in this direction. So there are large scale structure surveys with galaxies, PanoSTARRS, and large synoptic survey telescope. So these are going to probe the optical universe up to redshifts of 1 or 2. The whole sky, essentially. It's joint dark energy mission, which probes the dark matter distribution on larger scales in a smaller area of the sky, hopefully within 10 years or so. SKA probes distribution of matter in the universe in principle up to redshift of 10 or higher, possibly, whenever it comes online. So any of these could possibly tell us about different questions on the horizon physics. CMB surveys, WMAP is still ongoing. Planck will be online in 5 years. And who knows what the next CMB experiment will be. And there are SC cluster surveys. So this is this is another passion of mine, which I didn't tell you about. This is Senioev's Lubitsch cluster surveys. Atacama Cosmology Telescope, South Pole Telescope, Planck. All of these are going to tell you about the rare peaks on very large scales. And hopefully that's going to tell you something about the statistics on the horizon scale. But that's wishful thinking at this point. Needs to be backed up with more concrete calculations. So this is my last slide. And so this is the modern cosmology in perspective. So in the 60s, we discovered cosmic microwave background, which essentially started modern cosmology as we know it today. 70s, we discovered the dark matter. 80s, inflation. So these are different revolutions, essentially, in understanding of cosmology. In the 90s, CMB and isotropies were discovered by Kobe and later on the other experiments. At 2000s, in the late 90s and then 2000s, we found out about dark energy and cosmic acceleration from supernovae and then other complementary evidence. And the main question now, which everybody wants to know, is what is the next big revolution in cosmology? And that's the million-dollar question. And here is my prediction. I think the next decade will be the decade of primordial non-Gaussianity, where we learn about statistics on the horizon scales. Thank you.
Questions for the AS?
Yes.
Yeah, so do you understand yet the other possible measurement of ISW that doesn't see, the claims not to see a deviation like a systematic excess? We talked about this briefly before, but does the prison group that is when they predict something like that?
Yes.
So ISW possible measurement of CDXS.
Yeah. So this is really a technical point. There are two different camps in measuring ISW, correlation. Some people use correlation in real space, and some people use correlation in Fourier space. And they are not, or in harmonic space. They're not identical. I mean, if you had infinite data, they would be identical to each other. But if you have a whole sky, basically. If you don't, then they are not identical to each other. And then you're mixing, if you do things in real space, you're mixing different scales. And it's hard to judge basically what's going on. So I think that's what's happening. So those people do things in real space, but what I'm showing you is in Fourier space. So their things are actually statistically separate, yeah, independent. John?
Regarding the last stage. The paper appeared a week ago. I started looking at theories. And the good vector part was its inflation study.
Yes.
Which is called my vector part.
I recall that.
In order to get an FNL, large non-Gaussianity, they actually said that they needed 200 to 300 randomly distributed vector, massive vector part.
Yeah.
And my eyes are blinked.
Yeah.
So this is a potential signal of what's going to be coming. Because if this is true, then the inflation is possibly wrong. You have to really contrive it to make it work. If that turns out to be the case.
Well, that's one point of view. My point of view is that up to this point, we had luck too easy for us because we wanted a singular scalar field to explain basically the whole universe for us. Initial conditions, expansion history, perturbations, everything. And in real life, there is more than one scalar field. And we know that there is more than one field. We don't know about the scalar fields, but we know that there is more than one field in the universe. So these Kerr-Bertin models, so if you have more than one scalar field, one of them gives you expansion, accelerated expansion, another gives you perturbations, they can naturally give you large FMLs. Of course, people can argue about what naturally means. But I think, I don't think multiple scalar fields, and you don't need hundreds of them, you just need two of them. I don't think that's too contrived to rule out inflation. Of course, the alternative would be something like a quadratic, but there also you need an extra scalar field to do this. So I think if you have two scalar fields, that's fine. The problem with Hilbert's vector field theory is that if you have a single vector, I think it's very non-Gaussian. So you need a lot of them so that they cancel the effect of each other. So that's, I think, an inherent problem with that particular theory, with the vector inflation.
You need 300 vector fields because you have to get around the fact that the Feynman equations homogeneous.
Exactly.
So this is a very weird way of doing it.
That's right.
Sorry, it's my opinion.
Sure.
Yeah, so it doesn't bother you. I mean, there aren't many fields that you can observe, but actually none of them are scalar fields.
That's right. That's
and that doesn't bother you?
Not in particular, because I think most of my life I've been thinking about a scalar field. So
that's
yes. So I guess LHC will see it hopefully in a few years. I guess 5 years is that the time of scale. So if LHC doesn't see a scalar field, then at that point I might start.
But there are lots of composite scalar fields in nature. And the Higgs could easily be a composite scalar field, like the pion.
Is there
a model of the inflaton?
The pion is a surface
scalar field that explains.
Yeah, there's MSS models that are composite.
But they have the scalars in them. Okay. Yeah. So I mean, I guess the closest thing would be what John was describing, as far as I know. So those vector fields, that's I guess in a way contrived because you have to have lots of them. No, I don't know of a theory of inflation which doesn't rely on scalars or a composite scalar. So that maybe that the scalars are not fundamental scalars, but that's fine. Yes.
So switching to observational tests, small Gaussianity. There's a couple of things that come to my mind. You know, peculiar velocity is one where you're looking at the gradient of the potential. Gravitational lensing is another one. In both these cases, you can compare the mass, or really it's the potential, I guess, that's derived from these two distribution of galaxies. So is there a test there in that comparison that you can make to see whether the predictions or the models that you outlined follow through or not?
Do you mean for lensing or for?
You have the ISW and ISW model.
Yes.
A modulated ISW model, I guess. Is there another modulated lensing? Can you make a prediction of how, if you compare the number density of the galaxy, you see with lensing mass map, for example?
Absolutely. So there is comparable. I guess before people discovered this effect about galaxies, they usually thought that you could basically look at three-point function in galaxy, in lensing mass, for example, in galaxy mass. And in principle, eventually you can get comparable, comparable in accuracy to what you get from CMB. So I guess there are two problems. One is that you have intrinsic non-Gaussianity from structure formation. So that stops you at some point because structure formation is nonlinear. It's going to dominate primordial non-Gaussianity at a small enough of scales. And the other problem is the dynamical range that you have. So you need a lot of modes, basically, to be able to capture all these effects, And in principle, you can get that. You need a very big survey with good enough resolution. I guess it depends on what survey we're talking about. But you need to be able to resolve a structure on a small enough scale. So if there's large shot noise, that's going to kill you on a small scale as well. Or not if there is nonlinear clustering on a small scale. So here's the thing. The nice thing about galaxies is that you have this large scale modulation given to you, basically, for free. Because you have a scale of galaxies, and you have a large scale of your survey. And so that you can call that modulation for free. You don't have to resolve galaxies on their own, or you don't have to resolve a structure matter around galaxies. The fact that there is a galaxy that emits light, it's kind of funny that by its own can give you a correlation between very large scale models and very small scale models. Now, that doesn't suggest that you cannot do this with lensing surveys or with peculiar velocity surveys. But it's kind of a shortcut, I guess, if you will, just looking at galaxy surveys, because you don't have to do anything with it, and yet you can in principle detect with non-Gaussian. And anything else you want to do, like lensing or peculiar velocity, that relies on some extra processing that can complicate things, and in principle give you extra systematics. So that's my take on it. But of course, I mean, these are all complementary ways that must be applied and can potentially give you interesting results. Okay, so
hopefully we'll soon have some gravitational waves. Can you see any, interesting information for cosmology coming out of
that? Absolutely. So if Lisa flies and works, there will be signatures of lots of astrophysical objects. Hopefully, the claim is that there will be evidence, possibly extra dimensions or even leptogenesis, if there is any extra dimension. And there could be evidence of inflation in it, depending on the inflationary model. The thing about inflation, the inflationary signal is that it really depends on the inflationary model. So you can always have models that don't have any observable gravitational waves, or very little gravitational waves. So that's the problem with inflationary signal. But there are many other things you can, or at least quantum mechanically generated inflationary signal. There could be evidence from reheating, and that's something, an active area of research. There could be evidence from leptogenesis, or any kind of inhomogeneity that happened early on that you cannot see directly because the plasma is very thick, very thick. You might be able to see it in gravitational waves. So that's a very interesting avenue, I believe. And I think that there's much more that can be done and should be done in that direction. So you had a question? No? OK.
I had one question.
Sure.
So this larger signal of ISW, if you've been showing, so one explanation you're saying maybe primary than not Gaussian.
Yes.
But another one, perhaps that naively shows that there's a mismatch between what the background evolution is telling you and the growth of perturbation associated with it. Uh-huh. And people have played with this PPF or parameterized post-Friedman characterization to check for non-standard evolution of perturbation.
Yes.
So have people look, have you thought about how big of these PPFs would have to be to fit this?
Good, so that's the project that we should be working on, isn't it? No, I don't think anybody has thought about it, but that's a very good question. And yes, I can't think of any reason why this wouldn't be able to explain it. So if you have deviations from general relativity, that could possibly explain this. What I would worry about is it might screw something else. I'm not sure. Yeah.
You can see why you can't boost it too much, it's going to change elsewhere.
Yes. Yeah, so that's really the tough tip. I cannot say, but it depends on the kind of modification you think of. So, yeah, I don't have an answer for you. So that's why we'll be working on it, I guess. Yeah.
So, any other questions? Okay, well, let's thank Naish again.
Thank you.